Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started today. Call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today is May 23rd, and we had a couple of matters that are on the agenda for today. A public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3111A, and then a work session scheduled for House Bill 3450A. What I'm going to do is go ahead and open up a work session on 3450A. The reason I'm opening up the work session is to have a little bit of discussion with the committee. There have been a couple of different, let's say, suggested approaches to modify what we have before us. As you remember, this basically would reduce the wait time before someone would be able to go to work from 2 weeks to 72 hours. I've spoken with Representative Cameron. He is more comfortable with the current bill than having a waiver that would be applied at the current two-week wait. And my discussions with a couple other people, I think what I'd like to do, and I wanted to kind of open this up for, I guess, a little bit of discussion, is that we would go with, as the 3450A is currently written, which would reduce it to 72 hours, but state in there explicitly that the arbitration agreement, if there's going to be one, needs to be made available to the person at the time the offer is made. One of the concerns has been by having someone take an offer more than 2 weeks out, they give notice to their current employer, and then 3 days before they start, oh, by the way, here's this arbitration agreement that you will need to sign, and it jeopardizes the positioning, bargaining of where they're at, because they've already given notice to their current employer, then they kind of find themselves in, well, now I need to take this job, but if I'd known I was going to have an arbitration agreement, I may not have offered or taken the offer. Now, that's one side. The other issue, of course, we heard is in this economic times, you have people who are not currently working who want to go to work, and so that's where that 72 hours comes in. So I'm kind of, let's say, facilitating where we would maintain the 72 hours, but at the time the offer is actually made, if it's 72 hours before, 96 hours before, and if there's an arbitration agreement, that would need to be made, future employee would need to be made aware of that. So I want to kind of open that up for discussion. That's what, we don't have the amendment now, but that's what I'm planning on doing unless we come with some other type of resolution. And Doug, your mic.
Mr. Chair, the arbitration agreement would then be part of the job offer?
Yeah, I think it's basically giving notice that that there's an arbitration agreement. I actually think that that they should receive it at that time so they can actually, I mean, they're going to have to get it at 72 hours no matter what. That's when they're supposed to be able to, and if they wanted to talk to an attorney about what does this mean, how does this work, what rights am I potentially giving up, they would have that available. So it would seem appropriate that if the employer wants someone to accept a job that's going to require arbitration at the time the offer is made, that they receive the arbitration notice of it and a copy of it so they could actually process that on their own. And we still would have the 72 hours.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm more comfortable with the concept that you discussed. I realize that the dash A3s doesn't completely get us there. So I would, otherwise, I have reservations about voting for the bill the way it is. So.
All right. Other comments, thoughts? You want to think about it?
I would suggest go ahead and draft it. I'm certainly more comfortable with that, Mr. Chair, than I am with the threes. But I need to circle back with a couple folks on it and see if it meets standard.
That's fine with me. I have not talked to Representative Cameron about this latest. I did tell him that I was more comfortable with going with the 72, understanding the dilemma that some people could find themselves in. If you're given a notice, well, we're going to make you an offer, and you've got to wait 2 weeks. Oh, by the way, you can waive it by entering it now. To me, I think that could be considered maybe more pressure on the individual to sign it to start work earlier than the 72 hours. But I do also acknowledge that if someone actually is going to be hit or asked to enter employment with a arbitration agreement to be part of it, that they should have notice of it at the time of the offer so they can actually, before they make accept the offer, they can say, okay, I understand what you want, and I'm ready to do it.
Mr. Chair, it appears that just from the SMS that the that's the current policy right now. Under current law, they have to be given a written notice 2 weeks before, and this would just make it 72 hours before.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It would be nice to have clarification if they just get notice that they're going to have an arbitration clause or if they can actually get the language.
I was going to say that they would get it because we're tightening down the time, and it's not just the notice. I mean, at this point, they would actually receive it, and that in itself would be notice, but they'd have it so they could actually then do something with it instead of waiting for filling up the first day to sign it or something like that. So if that's all right, I'll go ahead and get that drafted and we can talk some more.
Yeah, and let's just make sure it isn't already in law that it's not in law that they have to get it at the beginning. I think with the 2 weeks, they have to get it at the beginning of the 2 week period, don't they? So that's what I'm saying, if we're just going to 72 hours, if that still, if we're doing it at the beginning, if it's already covered.
Right. But if they're giving, I guess the one part of this is that if they are making the offer prior to the 72 hours, they have to give it to them then. They couldn't wait until 72 hours after they made the offer. So I think that's the difference from my perspective, is that the time the offer's made, not knowing under the 72 hours, I mean, if that's when they first make the offer, that's one thing. But if they make the offer prior to that, they can't wait until 72 hours before they would start and then hand them the arbitration agreement. We may be already there. And essentially what the law currently is, except for 2 weeks versus 72 hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think it fits with intent.
So. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm just looking at the plain language, it's not clear to me it's clear that there needs to be a written employment offer, but it's not clear that the actual arbitration clause needs to be
provided. Okay.
All right. That just seems the plain language is there, but I don't know if there's anybody here who wants to testify.
Well, Chris, as someone here, I mean, I guess the question I would have is, does anyone have any questions that we need to bring them up? Or do you think? Well, I guess I'll say this. You've heard what the chair is looking at doing. Is there any feedback or comment that you would want to give to us regarding what we're talking about doing as an amendment?
Good morning.
If you'll give us your name before you say anything, that would be great.
I'm Beth Creighton. Good morning, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz. I'm here as an employment attorney. I represent employees in employment disputes for the last 17 years. And I guess the one comment that I do have about the proposed solution to the problem is that, you know, obviously if someone is being given a job offer, you know, 3 days in advance to and is notified, hey, I want you to start in 3 days and here's the arbitration clause, you know, we have very busy practices. I rarely get the opportunity to see a client within 72 hours of them contacting me. So even if they, in fact, contact an attorney within that time period, they won't necessarily be able to get an appointment or to get the advice that they need to understand that they're waiving their rights to a jury trial and the justice system as, you know, our government provides. So that would just be my one comment about that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
Kind of a general question.
Yes.
Ms. Creighton. How prevalent are arbitration agreements in employment contracts?
Well, they're getting more and more prevalent. And, you know, there's this big debate about whether or not there should even be arbitration clauses in employment because of the difference in bargaining power, so to speak, between the employee and the employer. An employee needs to live and needs to be able to feed their family, so they will pretty much sign whatever you put in front of them if they need a job. And they don't know when they're starting that, hey, this person's going to sexually harass me, or this person's going to, you know, I'm going to blow the whistle on this person, and I'm going to get fired, and I'm going to be forced into an arbitration where I don't have the benefit of the jury of my peers. Sometimes it actually comes back to bite employers in the nether regions. And I've had cases where arbitrators have awarded, you know, $500,000 in punitive damages against an employer, and there's no appeal process. So it's kind of like, hey, you made your bed, you know, you have to lie in it. And I think that the general consensus among the business world is that arbitration clauses make things, arbitrations make things go faster. They get to pay for their own justice system and a judge who is the arbitrator, and that the arbitrator will be more inclined to rule in the employer's favor because of the promise of repeat business. If they're good to the employer, they get to be hired by the employer again. Also, you know, there's also the issue of the payment of the arbitration fees when you have like a minimum wage worker who's being expected to pay thousands of dollars in arbitration fees. You know, are they really going to be able to afford that? Because it really becomes a deterrent to an employee to enforce their rights under the employment laws.
Right. Bill.
Ma'am, aren't all the states preempted to a certain extent by the Federal Arbitration Act in this area? I mean, we can deal with the procedure, but a significant part of this is preempted by federal law, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, there are ways that state law comes into it through the contractual law provisions. So it's a contract, whether or not you have an arbitration clause. And so under state law, you can say this contract's unconscionable because it requires a minimum wage worker to pay thousands of dollars. In addition, I understand that there's now federal legislation pending from Senator Franken on this very issue after AT&T versus Concepcion that just came down from the Supreme Court recently. So that might change as well, not to confuse the issue.
So let me ask you, I have not seen these arbitration clauses or contracts that are entered into. Does it now explicitly say that you're giving up these rights that you...
No. You know, the ones that I've seen, it says you agree to arbitrate all disputes through, you know, whatever arbitration service they designate. And, you know, sometimes they say that the employer, you know, has the right to go to court to protect their trade secrets, but you don't have the right to go to court to protect your rights in an employment situation. So there's no real explanation about what arbitration means. I think the general public doesn't even understand what the word is and what you're giving up. I mean, some people, you know, I have no problem with post-dispute arbitration. You know, if an employee finds that they are in a dispute and they don't want to wait a year or 2 years, however long it's going to take to litigate the issue, and they decide after the dispute comes up, hey, I want to arbitrate this because it'll be faster. I have no issue with that, but when you're saying I'm going to give up my rights before I even know that my rights are going to be violated,
I don't think that's, you know, for us to be discussing.
Right, exactly.
I mean, we already have that here.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out it as I try to let's say, negotiate this and compromise out for people what, if anything, I might want to consider or have the committee consider including in the agreement. Maybe mm-hmm. we need to put in there, upon entering this agreement, you would be giving up these rights, and maybe putting that in there. I mean, the thing about having the right to get to an attorney, I understand your practice seems very busy, you need to plan things out, but I also think that if someone really wants to talk to an attorney, they're going to be able to talk to somebody within a reasonable period of time, and I'm not ready to try to broker something that's going to say, what's that magic date of how many days?
Well, and I think that that is a very good suggestion, Senator Prusansky. This means, you know, in different, you know, consumer agreements, it says, you know, you have to have certain language in bold and you have to have it in, you know, at least 12-point font and that kind of thing. An indication that an employee is giving up their rights to go to trial and have a jury hear their disputes, I mean, I think that's a good suggestion.
All right. Other comments or questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm thinking back to when we did the bill in 2007, and most of the focus was on the non-compete clauses.
Correct.
And it really seemed to make a difference. There was sort of a different discussion about whether these are sort of minimum wage or more blue-collar worker, or if it's, you know, people in the high-tech sector who would take the time to go have an attorney look at their contract or look at their agreement and negotiate. I think it's a very different situation, and to try to put everybody in the same category if it's a sort of an at-will employee versus somebody who's, you know, investing a lot of time in negotiating a contract with the employer. So that's just a comment that it's, there's really two different types of people we're talking about.
But I mean, these
statute would be, applies to all of them.
I mean, these pretty much are at-will employees, mm-hmm. with the under, I guess, the exception mm-hmm. that whatever contractual agreement they enter into may, let's say, give them more protection or coverage than what would be the norm, unless they're through some other representative group. That's
Chair Prusansky, I did want to follow up on something that Senator Bonamici said. Under the non-compete legislation that was passed a couple years ago, that has an income level, which I thought was really useful because, you know, I'm seeing arbitration clauses. I'm arbitrating a case right now. Minimum wage worker works as a cook in a restaurant, only speaks Thai. So to me, having that kind of clause in a minimum wage worker's contract is, you know, they're not going to be sophisticated enough to understand exactly what that means, or, you know, you don't think when you're beginning, it's kind of like a you know, marital contract, you know, you do a prenup, you know, you don't know when you enter into the employment relationship that you're going to have a dispute later on.
Okay. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and close the work session. I'm going to speak with Representative Cameron regarding some of the discussions that happened today and see where he might feel would be comfortable making maybe some modifications. So with that, unless there's something else for this item, we'll close the work session. And we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on House Bill 3111A.
Senator, members of the committee, House Bill 3111A comes in from Representative Barker, establishes a process for veterinary facilities to remove a domestic animal if the owner does not retake possession of it, allows the unclaimed animal to be placed with a rescue group or shelter or to be adopted, allows the animal to be euthanized if placement or adoption are not reasonable, modifies the current meat laws too.
All right, Glenn, thank you for being here. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on 3111? Okay, Glenn.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky, Vice Chair Cruz, committee members. My name is Glenn Kolb. I'm Executive Director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and on behalf of our membership here in support of House Bill 3111A, you know, animals in Oregon, as they are in all other states, are defined as property. And so when a client brings an animal to a veterinary clinic for treatment and care and agrees upon the treatment, a lien is automatically attached to that animal. And I suppose you can look at it, the lien is in some ways protection for the practice to recover possibly any unpaid cost of that animal, or if somebody leaves that animal and doesn't come to retrieve it. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But if a veterinarian decides that it's necessary to foreclose on a lien, the practice must take a number of steps as required by law. First, if the patient is a dog or cat, the practice must retain that animal for a minimum of 15 days before the foreclosure process can even start. It's 30 days of its livestock, but for this bill is specifically addressing domestic animals. Second, the practice must notify the owner of the practice's intent by sending a certified or registered letter that they're going to start the foreclosure process. Third, the practice must give notice of foreclosure sale by posting it in a public place or near the county courthouse. Fourth, the notice must include a description of the animal, the name of the owner or the reputed owner, the amount due on the lien, the time and place of the sale, and the name of the person foreclosing on the lien. In this case, it would be the veterinary practice. And then fifth, once that initial 15-day period is over and the certified or registered letter goes out, then the owner of the practice must keep that animal for another 30 days for that foreclosure process to be completed. So if you look from start to finish, it's about 45 days total time if the foreclosure process goes through its entirety. I mean, our concern is that, one, you know, the current procedure for foreclosure is pretty cumbersome, and the time it takes a veterinarian or somebody else for that transfer of ownership become the legal owner of that animal, we believe is really is a disservice to the animal as well as to the practice. Now, veterinary medicine is pretty much a cash business. I guess that by that I mean is that once an animal is cared for and treated, usually payment is expected upon picking up that animal. But at any given time, we recognize that sometimes clients have difficulty paying for the animal or for that full bill. And when that happens, most veterinary practices will recognize this, and they'll work with that client on a payment plan or seek some other remedy. And then if they can't come to that full agreement, often what practices do is they write off the unpaid balances of business loss. There are other times where there are clients who simply refuse to pay for the full bill, or they don't accept the outcome and treatment of that animal. When this happens, against veterinary practices will attempt to resolve the matter, sometimes in the case as I just presented. Again, if they're unable to, most will return the animal to its owner and then send the client to collections. You know, veterinary practices are not in the habit or really don't want to have to hold animals and retain animals for a lengthy period of time, so they want those animals returned back to the owner. There also is a client who simply, in our estimation, relinquishes any responsibility of pet ownership in this case by not picking up or retrieving that animal from the veterinary practice for whatever reason. In essence, they're abandoning that animal and they're expecting the veterinarian to take care of it. This does happen. In this case, many times phone calls to that client go unanswered or unreturned. Some practices will send a letter to the client, the last known address, but get no response from the client. And under current law, the only recourse a veterinary practice has to remedy this is to start to seek foreclosure, especially when those animals, when you have an unresponsive owner. Out of necessity, during this whole time process, you've got an animal that's confined to a cage, you know, kept in a cage or a kennel at the practice, and in theory, it could last up to 45 days, which we don't believe is a good service to that animal. The situation can be further complicated if the animal needs ongoing care or additional treatment. You know, depending on the animal's condition, a veterinary practice is going to provide comfort care, but to what extent should the veterinary practice provide additional care? Animals are property, and so who's going to authorize any additional treatment or care? The veterinarian is going to have to make that call if he or she is not hearing back from the client. Unfortunately, the animal is caught in the middle of this, and the practice continues to incur ongoing expense for providing housing, care for the animal, and treatment for that animal. Now, House Bill 3111A does two things. First, it amends current lien law shortening the minimum time frame from 15 days to 5 days that a veterinary practice must retain that animal before they can start the foreclosure process. Under this process, the practice would go ahead and still have all the notification requirements, send out the certified letter, have the postings, but that process from start to finish is shortened from a total of 45 days to 35 days. While this option is better than the current lien law, we still believe it's impractical and in some ways untenable for both the patient and the practice. Second, House Bill 3111 gives veterinary practice a second choice, one that we find is better for the animal but also more reasonable for the practice too. In this case, the practice would send a certified letter notifying the owner that the animal will be removed from the practice if the owner doesn't retrieve the animal within 4 days after receipt of that certified letter. With a second choice, the practice would not have to meet the posting requirements under current law, and according to legislative counsel, they couldn't seek a recovery of costs in court. Most practices, as they often do now when they experience this, would write off the total amount owed as a business loss. Now, under that second choice, if the practice were to choose this option, it could do the following: place the animal with a rescue group or animal shelter, adopt out the animal, which we encourage both of those, or as last resort, humanely euthanize that animal, especially if the animal is quite sick or diseased. You know, for those of us in the veterinary profession, the second option is the most efficient way to address the animals abandoned at clinics. And the process is shortened and allows practices to more quickly find good homes for these animals. And with that time frame is equivalent to procedures currently followed by animal control agencies and humane shelters. And so we appreciate your time and consideration. And I guess I have a couple examples more recently. You know, what I can't tell you is how many specific times a practice will go through the whole foreclosure process. But what I can tell you is we receive phone calls from about 30 to 40 practices yearly about this. Practices are kind of at the wit's end to say, we've had this animal for all this period of time, what are we supposed to do? And this represents about 8% of the practices in the state. Two of the more recent incidences, there is one practice on the North Oregon coast that called after having a bird in the practice for 45 days. The owner has not paid the bill. The owner has come in occasionally, says, I want to take my bird home, but won't pay the bill. The practice says, legally, we can hold on to this bird until you pay your bill, but what does the practice do? So they've called us, and I think they're starting that foreclosure process, but they have another 30 days, total of about 75 days if you're going to go from start to finish for maintaining and keeping that bird. The second situation that came this last call this last week, and this actually is a case in Senator DeWitt's hometown of Klamath Falls. You know, there's kind of a variation of the theme. Animal was taken to veterinary practice. The animal was quite ill. A number of procedures were done or tests run. Unfortunately, the animal did die. The owner has not paid the bill, and the owner was refused to pick up the deceased animal. The practice has called the owner a number of times, and the owner must have ID on his phone because the owner is not answering that phone. The practice has used a second line of the practice to call the owner. They picked up the phone, but then asked, well, who's on the line? They said, this is the name of the practice. The owner hung up. So the practice has wrapped up the animal. It's deceased, and it's in a refrigerator. They're saying, what do we do? The lien law doesn't address whether an animal is alive or deceased, but if they want to follow that procedure, they're going to have to go for 45 days total time to decide what they can do for properly taking care of the animal. So these are just some of the situations we see throughout the course of a year, and if I could answer any questions, I'd gladly do so.
All right. Questions first, Senator Bartolomeucci.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kolb. Appreciate the concern. I'm just imagining a scenario, and maybe you can tell me how you can avoid this from happening. Under this second choice that seems to make sense, but say, for example, there's a senior citizen, and her puppy's in the vet, and she has to go to the hospital, and she's in the hospital for a few days. And there's only 4 days from the receipt of the letter, and the letter comes, gets in a stack of mail, and she's in the hospital, and a week later she gets out of the hospital and her puppy's gone. So what do you do in those types of situations where it seems like the situation where that you want to avoid happening? So is there enough flexibility?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, again, you know, I'll go back to in my experience in being in contact with veterinary practices throughout the course of a year and speaking with so many of those throughout that year is, you know, veterinarians want to return animals to the homes. Their greatest challenge are for people who are non-responsive. In this case, my guess is that individual, they're going to have a relationship with that veterinarian. So when veterinarians have those relationships and understand who these people are, they will work with them. But it's when you have somebody who seems either dismissive or unresponsive, it's a great challenge. What do we do with that animal? So it does shorten the time frame, similar to stray animals, humane shelters, and others. But in this case, I mean, I would believe and I would hope that a veterinarian would not take that course until they've had that chance to talk with that owner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some comments. In veterinary medicine, you know, we have a patient-veterinarian relationship. Really, it's an owner veterinarian relationship, because I'm still waiting for the first patient to call me. So it's always the owner. So there's always that relationship. What we're dealing with here is more the person who brings the animal in may or may not ever plan to have the animal picked up. They'll tell you, doc, do whatever you can, and under their breath says, I doesn't make any difference because I'm not going to pay you anyway, and you're never going to see me again. It isn't uncommon to have somebody pick up an animal that's been injured and bring it in and say it's their animal and, you know, maybe pay a small deposit to get it in the process. They walk out the door, you never see them again. The other thing I'd bring up is that most veterinary clinics try to run as near capacity as possible. And if you have one of these animals that is in a kennel and in a run for up to 75 days, not only do you have the cost of taking care of them, which isn't maybe all that big, but you have the avoided income of not being able to use that kennel and run for somebody else, you know, that's somebody else's pet, which may run $25 to $50 a day or whatever, depending. I mean, I think most board now is $12 to $15 just for simple board. Hospitalization probably from $35 to $75 in the ballpark. So you're talking about a lot of loss because someone dropped an animal off that they had never had any intention of coming to pick up.
All right, question.
Well, if I may, too, the Oregon Humane Society is not here this morning, but I've talked with Sharon Harm, the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society, and she unfortunately is not able to be here because she's attending a meeting out of state. But they did support House Bill 3111A in the House and have supported this as amended. I just wanted to raise that.
Lynn, I guess the only question I have is when you look under the second option, it talks about what the veterinary practice will try to do. First, place the animal with the rescue or animal shelter. Second, adopt the animal out. And last resort, humanely utilize the animal. From your testimony, I understand if you have an animal that's very sick or high care and it doesn't look well, that last resort is probably the one that they may be looking at sooner just because of the on a case-by-case basis. But is there under the bill a obligation on the part of the practice to make contact with a rescue group or an animal shelter and or to go through some type of attempt to adopt before they put the animal down?
Chair Brzezinski, committee members, there isn't. We talked about that a little bit in the House, too, and it's, you know, it came up. And one, there's even talk about, you know, that the humane euthanasia, and it's an option because it's important for veterinarians to have the ability to make their professional judgment and decision on that animal. Certainly is our encouragement and our preference, as I believe, really believe it is with practice, that they're going to find homes for healthy animals. And perhaps Senator Witz, in his experience, he would bear that out too. It's in my 23 years of doing what I'm doing and being in contact with so many practices throughout the year, we just do not hear about that convenience euthanasia. Veterinarians want to find homes, and one of the things I do that they often do too, before maybe even considering foreclosure, if somebody's challenged with not being able to pay for the bill or care for that animal, they'll talk with them about transferring ownership at that time up front to say, I'll take this animal because I'll find a home for it. And I, you know, I can tell you the number of practices that I've been in contact with where veterinarians and their staff all have additional animals because they've taken them for clients who, for whatever reason, cannot care for it. And I see Senator Witsit smiling over here because he's experienced the same thing.
So those, when we go take our cat, and that's the cats I get to pet, that are kind of become the office cats?
Often, yes, that's correct. Yes.
The one-eyed cat, the three-legged dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I don't think there's anyone else. I'll go ahead and close the public hearing, and I'm ready to open the work session. If everyone's ready to go, I'll go ahead and open up that work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3111A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3111A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and I assume our resident veterinarian will be.
I think that's appropriate.
All right, so Senator Wesson, if you'd be so kind, be our carrier, that'd be great. I'll close the work session on 3111A, and tomorrow we are scheduled, I think, to start at 8:30. We are going to talk about that. We had a conversation on Thursday, Council and I, and he suggested that we start later. And I said, oh, that's fine. I said, let's just make sure everyone gets notice. And I apologize that y'all didn't get notice before, I think in some cases this morning.
So I apologize too.
Yeah, it is what it is. All right, so with that, we're adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30.